I was born a refugee. I don't know if I'll ever see the old farmhouse I've heard about, but it's where I belong, there is no doubt. 'Cause my whole family is from that farm. We never did nobody harm. And if you're confused by what you've heard, let me boil it down to a single word. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I have heard my grandpa say that on the street, most every day, the neighbor's kids would kick a ball with my dad when he was small. We were Christians, they were Jews, but it was no big deal. Religious views, so it was strange when at the point of a gun across the river we had to run. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. We had Depke, we had songs, and we all knew where we belonged. We grew crops, life was good there in the land where Jesus stood. Now we're scattered everywhere, but there's no peace anywhere. And I'm just searching for some kind of sign, for some way back to Palestine. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home. I wanna go home.
Thanks for listening to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. If you're just joining our program, we're listening to a debate on Iran's nuclear ambitions. The panelists debate how the world should respond to Iran's nuclear program, and topics include the U.S. and Israeli positions in the Middle East, the consequences of launching a war against Iran, and Iran's influence in the region.
Okay, Charles, it was a big part of your opening argument, the case for stopping Iran to allow the non-proliferation treaty to continue. Go deeper on that for us. Why do you think this particular region is so different than the examples that Fareed and Nasser have given with China, with Russia, with India and Pakistan, and most recently with North Korea?
Because the conditions, geopolitical conditions, are radically different, and they keep referring back to this stable Cold War deterrence in a bilateral relationship between the two established world powers, the U.S. and the Soviet Union. First of all, the nostalgia is slightly overdone. Anybody who lived through October 1962 knows how close a run thing it was, how close we came within hours of a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union. So even this, the great one example of how we can live with this indefinitely, shows, and Kissinger himself talked about this, how inherently unstable it is. It's the only alternative. Once the Soviets have 10,000 weapons and the U.S. also does, there is no alternative. But we're now in a situation in history where Iran has none, and we can avoid that. Avoid a Cuban missile crisis, which would be at a much higher elevated level if Iran ever went nuclear. Why would we choose a world in which Iran, this unstable, extremist, Islamist, aggressive power, would possess these weapons, a country that declares its intention to annihilate a member state of the UN? And you will have noticed that our opponents said nothing about the issue of hyperproliferation. They keep referring to this single example, the stable bilateral deterrence. But what will happen in the Middle East, as everybody understands, is you will get all these countries, small, but some of them rich, some technologically advanced, developing nukes. And then we have a situation where you go from nuclear checkers, which is really easy, U.S. and Soviets, to three-dimensional chess, shifting alliances, revolutionary governments, unstable regimes. Imagine in the hands of seven or eight of these countries, nuclear weapons, countries where they could easily have accidental or unauthorized use. they don't have a tradition of civilian control of nuclear weapons as in the West. How easy it would be to turn one officer or another, as we see in Afghanistan every day, an officer, Afghan will turn on a Western ally. And there's also the issue of
Charles, a flurry of signals here of people that want in on this. So I'm going to go quickly to Fareed, then to Amos, and then to Nasser.
Well, it turns out we have an actual historical experiment as to whether or not there is proliferation in the Middle East. You see, it turns out there was a Middle East that had no nuclear weapons, and then one Middle Eastern power introduced nuclear weapons into the Middle East. The name of that country is, of course, Israel. Israel now has close, as I said, between 200 and 500, depending on whom you believe, very sophisticated weapons. As it turns out, none of the countries surrounding Israel, which are technically still at war with Israel, have gone nuclear as a result of that. So if the hyperproliferation scenario that Charles is so devoted to were true, why is it that when their sworn enemy, the country that the opposing team keeps reminding us the Arabs hate and want to get rid of, got nuclear weapons, it did not trigger proliferation?
Let me answer that.
The truth of the matter is every country that has received some kind of security guarantee from the United States has not chosen to proliferate. True of Japan, that's true of South Korea, that's true of Canada. The touching faith in the non-proliferation treaty from Charles Krauthammer is rich. The truth of the matter is the reason that people are not proliferating is because they get guarantees from the United States, guarantees that the United States has provided to the moderate Arab states and, of course, has provided to Israel. But you asked
a question. Is it a rhetorical or were you asking a real question?
Well, you were asking several, so if yours were rhetorical, mine are rhetorical.
Why is it that when Israel acquires a nuclear weapon, you don't get hyperproliferation? The answer is easy and simple. Israel has no intention to annihilate a neighboring country.
Oh.
Do you think Egypt, Saudi Arabia live in terror that one day out of the blue Israel is going to destroy Cairo or Riyadh? No, right. The reason that the Israeli weapon is not a threat and doesn't cause...
So Charles, let me understand this. Egypt, which has fought three wars with Israel, isn't worried about a war with Israel.
You can ask rhetoricals and make a speech, or you can ask and I'll give you the answer.
Egypt, which has fought three wars with Israel, isn't worried about a war with Israel.
You can ask rhetoricals and make a speech, or you can ask and I'll give you the answer. Everybody understands in the region, Israel is not going to start nuclear aggression. It's inconceivable. Whereas Iran, which is intervening in Gaza, arming in Hezbollah, intervening in Syria and elsewhere, is a nation that when it threatens to annihilate another, people take seriously. And the Saudis aren't acting or pretending or being cynical when they say if Iran...
Okay, Charles, we have a lot of people. Hold on a second. I want equal time for all the debaters. So I'm going to go to Valley Nasser, then back to you, Amos. So we're going to each side a chance
on this. First of all, as you've already said, threat is in the eyes of the beholder. And the Arab countries do take Israel's nuclear capabilities as a strategic game changer. Maybe not annihilation, but it's a strategic game changer. But there is no evidence that actually hyperproliferation would happen. It seems to be more of an American argument in order to basically argue against the case of Iran going nuclear. In fact, it looks like we've done more to goad countries to try to say that they want to go nuclear. We're supporting Egypt, UAE, Saudi Arabia, Jordan, all of them to establish nuclear facilities. And I don't think actually countries can easily build nuclear capabilities in the Middle East. Iran's nuclear program goes back several decades to the time of the Shah. Most of these countries we're talking about don't have the infrastructure to build a nuclear weapons program. And as General Yadlin said, okay, Saudi Arabia can go to Pakistan and get it. Then what are we doing here? These two countries are our allies. UAE is our ally. We have much more leverage to prevent proliferation in this region than we had with Iran. To me, it seems we're making the case for all of these countries to go nuclear because it proves our case against Iran. But there's no real evidence for it.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Okay, General?
Yeah, I think the fact that you repeat and repeat again and repeat again a lie is not making it a truth. And I'm speaking about the number of bombs that Israel has. Israel declares that it will not be the first to introduce nuclear weapons to the Middle East. Israel is the only country that under a threat that it will be wiped off the map. I don't recognize any other country in the Middle East. And whenever our neighbors will make peace with us, I guess even the capabilities that we have will not be there. So Israel behave very responsibly. As Farid have said, we have four wars with Egypt and never spoke about anything besides conventional weapons. So it's a different behavior if you compare it to the way the Iranians are speaking and what they are doing. And I describe what they are doing all over the Middle East, and you cannot ignore it. Vali, you know, and you read, as I read, the WikiLeaks. And the Saudis are saying, we are not going to tolerate a nuclear Iran. And believe me, they are your allies, but they don't trust you anymore. They don't trust you because of what happened in Egypt. They don't trust you because you are not stopping Iran from becoming nuclear. They don't trust you because of the Israeli-Palestinian issue. And they will become nuclear, no doubt about it. And we already spoke about a multi-player balance in the Middle East, which is so unstable and so dangerous that it's not only us that don't want to live in this neighborhood. It's you that don't want to live in this neighborhood. Because when Iran will be the hegemon, the price of oil will be $200, $300 a barrel, and it will stay there forever. So it's your problem, it's not ours.
Two final interventions on this point. We're going to go to Farid, and then Charles, you'll have the last word, and we'll move on to another topic.
I think it's very important for us to have a conversation about what happens if the strategy that the opposing team wants takes place. That is to say, we're living in a world of bad choices. That's the world of international relations. That's the world of international politics. You don't have wonderful, clean solutions that make the problem go away. So imagine the scenario. What we do is the United States and or Israel goes and engages in the third Middle Eastern war in a decade. We go and strike Iran. What is going to happen?
We haven't suggested this, by the way.
If we cannot tolerate it, the logical consequence is one you will have to live with. So let's play it out. What will happen is that the regime will get strengthened. It happens everywhere. 1 week after 9/11, George Bush's approval ratings were 91%. The Green Movement will be destroyed in Iran. The regime will be able to rebuild its capabilities very easily. The nuclear budget for Iran for the nuclear civilian program is currently $300 million. They make about $50 billion off their oil revenues. This is a drop in the bucket. They will have radicalized the Middle East. They will have gained purchase on the Arab street. All this for a two-year delay, for a three-year delay. What are you then going to do? Bomb them every 2 years? Hope that one day, that somehow in our fantasy version, the country that we keep bombing turns into a moderate liberal democracy and suddenly embraces Western values? What is far more likely is, of course, that they will get radicalized, and they will get even more radicalized. Imagine if we had done what Charles wanted in the 1950s and had a rollback strategy. He says, we couldn't do it with the Soviets once they got 10,000 missiles, but they didn't in the 50s, and there were many people arguing we should have had a preemptive war. Imagine what would have happened then. Imagine if we had done that in China and engaged in preemptive war with China. Would any of these regimes have mellowed? Would they have gotten integrated into the world the way they have? No, they would have been radicalized, violent, unstable regimes, and that is the fate we are condemning ourselves to if we launch another war in the Middle East.
Well, Charles, that has to be one of the nubs of this debate.
I'd like to answer the non-rhetorical.
Yeah?
If we're going to ask questions in here, we should at least accept that there might be an answer. Farid is giving us this scenario of what will happen if and when Israel or the U.S. attacks, rallying to the government, destruction of the Green Movement. And he went on and on. He elaborated on all the details. The problem with his analysis is we have two actual empirical historical examples of exactly what he's talking about, the preemptive denuclearization of a country. General Yadin here beside me was involved in the first. He dropped the bombs on the first. Iraq, 1981. The reaction from Iraq, zero.
They rebuilt their
Second,
nuclear program,
they,
however.
Did they go to war? Did they attack? Was there a rallying? No.
It took more than 2 years.
Number two, they rebuilt their nuclear program, precisely what I pointed out.
When Gulf War happened, what the inspectors found was an Iraqi nuclear program, which had been built after Osirik.
They did not.
10 years, not 2 years.
This was 10 years later. The West went into Iraq and found that it had not rebuilt and created a bomb. So it gained a decade. Number two. In 2007, there was an attack on the Syrian facility from North Korea that was a nuclear facility. Reaction? Zero. Syria didn't even announce the attack. Second, if we had not done that, if the Israelis, acting on behalf of the West, I would argue, had not done that, What would be happening in Syria today? The world is terrified about the loose chemical and biological weapons that are in Syria that we know are there, the regime has declared, and that the jihadists and the al-Qaeda elements in Syria could easily acquire. That's why we're so vigilant, the United States standing on the border in Jordan as a way to preempt the transfer. The reason there are no nukes involved is because of the preemption. That's why the hyperproliferation is so important. And the blithe assurance that we get from our opponents that somehow there would be this great reaction to rallying to the regime. This regime in Iran is detested by the overwhelming majority of the people, and particularly by the young, as we saw in the Green Revolution. It was suppressed. If there were, for example, a U.S. attack that not only attacked nukes, but attacked elements of regime strength, like the Revolutionary Guards, that could be the occasion for a revival of the revolution. The Revolutionary Guards who tortured the young people in the streets are not heroes, and they would not become heroes if they were to be the victims of a U.S. or Israeli attack on the nuclear facilities. I think it could have the opposite effect, galvanizing a population that hates an oppressive theological regime at a time where the regime would be at its weakest.
Nasser, you're the expert on Iran. Tell us why that's not true.
First of all, to the first point, Syria and Iraq are not Iran. In terms of size, capability, location, size of population, amount of weight they have in the Middle East, the reaction for Iran could potentially be orders of magnitude different. Secondly, I don't know of any population that is going to side with the outsiders bombing its country, especially because this is not about democracy. We are not putting sanctions on Iran for democracy and human rights. We're not bombing Iran for democracy and human rights. We're bombing it and pressuring it for something that potentially the Iranian people actually believe in. It's their technology. Their government has told them this is for peaceful purposes. And the Iranians are probably as affectionate about their nuclear program as the Pakistanis or Indians are about theirs.
What about Libya last year?
Well, Libya is not Iran.
We bombed, and the population applauded us.
You were bombing them not for their nuclear program. You were bombing them to protect them from the authoritarian regime.
You just said no government is attacked and the people rally on behalf of the attackers.
I gave you an example that happened within a year. No, the pretext matters. What makes you think the Iranians would rally? Does the example of 1953, when we intervened in Iran and the reaction we got, suggest that the Iranians would side with us? Or the example of the Iran-Iraq war, when as soon as Saddam attacked, even the moderate, liberal, democratic population, they all hurried to the clerics?
Because they hate a regime that shoots young women in the street, tortures demonstrators, and then delivers the body to the family. That's why they would rally if there were people who opposed their oppressors and their torturers.
And when it happened in Libya,
they rallied
and supported
the United States.
Are you saying Iran or Iraq? Did you get the last letter mixed up? Because we heard all this about the Iraq war. The Iraqis were going to love us because we were bombing them into freedom and democracy.
And it didn't quite work out that way.
I just want to give our guest who's come all the way from Israel here and is on 2 o'clock in the morning, Tel Aviv time.
A few moments,
3 o'clock, sir. I'm sorry, yeah. 3 o'clock, some time on the stage. Go ahead.
I want to remind the audience the resolution today. The resolution is not whether to attack Iran or not. The resolution is whether the world can live with a nuclear Iran. And since they don't have arguments, they went to the attack. We are not suggesting attacking Iran. We suggest not let Iran be nuclear by having a tough sanctions, by doing everything that short of war, and this was not done yet. Only in the last year, the world imposed a crippling sanctions. If we would have done it a decade ago, the question was not here by now, because the regime is a hated regime. It's a hated regime. And I heard the argument, if you just sanction them, the people will rally behind the regime. Never happened. Never happened. The people hate the regime. There is no so many old Iranians. 65% of them are very young, and they never knew the Shah, and they blame the Islamic Republic for all the bad things in Iran. And I think the time that we will buy by tough sanctions will change the regime, and we are not calling to attacking Iran unless it's the last resort. And once again, I'm not speaking on invading another country. What you have done in Iraq was a mistake. But you have a very good air force that can surgically solve the problem. I'm not recommending it yet.
Well, let's move on to another topic area of this. And, you know, what is a monk debate without a little bit of a contribution from Dr. Henry Kissinger? So we caught up with Dr. Kissinger in New York last week. Let's have a listen to his intervention in this debate. Roll tape.
Thank you, Rudyard. For a decade and a half, American presidents from both political parties have declared that an Iranian nuclear military capability is unacceptable and that no option is off the table in preventing it. If Iran emerges from this process, which was joined also by other members of the UN Security Council, with a military nuclear capability, the psychological and strategic balance in the region will be transformed. The countries of the region and elsewhere will look to the development of nuclear weapons for their own security. Non-proliferation as an international goal will be ended or severely jeopardized. The credibility of Western strategy will be severely damaged. It is essential that the United States and its allies define what they mean by Iranian nuclear military capability and what they mean by the term unacceptable.
Fareed, let me start with you. I want to zero in on that key line of what Dr. Kissinger said. The credibility of Western strategy will be severely damaged. Your president, in the context of this recent election, had to walk towards a red line on Iran that's very close to our resolution tonight. It's about capability. It's about the ability to assemble a device as opposed to a working device. In some ways, has the train already left the station? Is this... Is U.S. position able to walk back from what Dr. Krauthammer and General Yadlin are arguing?
Well, I think, first of all, how do you argue with that accent, right? he was my debate partner the last time we did the monk debates, and so I naturally have great respect for him. I think that the United States' position on this issue, which is a somewhat technical point but worth going into, is understandably ambiguous. You do not want to signal in advance exactly at what point you would go to war. Do you know who else has exactly the same position? The government of Israel. Even though the Israeli prime minister has been asking Washington to draw a red line, Israel itself has not drawn a red line, and I would argue they are right not to draw a red line. You want to keep the other guy guessing. You want to keep the pressure on. You don't want to be entirely clear as to when, you know, you don't want to give the other person your timetable for war. It's one thing if they do something, an action like invading a country, that triggers an obvious response. But in a situation like this, we retain much more room to maneuver and much more flexibility if we maintain some degree of strategic ambiguity, as the Israelis are doing. It is important to point out the Iranians do not have nuclear weapons.
There is superstitious now for something completely different.